Jessica B. Harris is one of the most prolific food historians writing today. Her work focuses largely on the foods of the African diaspora, and her cookbooks have delved into the culinary traditions of a wide range of regions, West Africa, Brazil, the Caribbean, and the American South. She visited us back in June to discuss her latest, High on the Hog, a culinary journey from Africa to America, which is a historical examination of African and African-American foods and culinary traditions from the beginning of the slave trade to the present day. Listeners told us they enjoyed the conversation, and we're replaying it for you on this long holiday weekend. I began by asking Jessica B. Harris, wasn't your first cookbook about Africa? Are you working your way back to the United States?
Actually, no. I started out with a cookbook about foods made with peppers and chilies from around the world called Hot Stuff, Cookbook in Praise of the Pequot. So that was where it started. And then the second one was Iron Pots and Wooden Spoons, Africa's Gifts to New World Cooking. Certainly badly defined, because neither the iron pots nor the wooden spoons were probably Africa's gifts. But the original title was, what was it? Okra, beans, and collard greens.
Would have been fine, but... So was it an editor who forced you to do the other thing?
Yeah, you know, editorial decisions, the marketing folks. But what happened was that set up a culinary continuum, and then somehow or other I've been sort of making stops on the journey, if you will.
You write that High on the Hog is both a beginning and an end for you. What do you mean by that?
I'm not sure. I actually have not got an immediate new book in head. I've got some family stuff I kind of need to get on with. Gray hair. It's a gray hair issue. It's like I've got some other tales I think I need to tell as well.
Well, this is not just a cookbook, but very much a work of history. So were you approaching it differently than your previous books?
Well, the other books were cookbooks. The other books were absolutely cookbooks. And this one only has 23 recipes, most of them archival or from other books that I've written. So the idea of recipe is different in this one. This is more about narrative.
You say a large part of your work has been to, quote, untaint African-American history through studying food.
Oh, hoisted on my own petard.
were you hoping to convey that in this book?
I think so. I think one of the things that happens is the question of enslavement in this country is such a thorny one and such a knotty one, and we're not really sure where we are, what we feel, what we think. And certainly looking at what happened through food sort of takes some of that taint, if you will, off. But equally, it allows us to understand something about the entrepreneurial, about the cultural, about the personal. All of those stories can come together kind of on the plate.
Although the South certainly isn't the only region with a large black population, there is something particularly comforting and American about Southern food. Why do you think that is?
Well, while people sort of say, Southern food is, it's our regional cuisine. It's the one that resonates the most with most of us. I think in many ways that becomes tied then to the African experience in not only the United States, but in the hemisphere, to that whole notion of so many people who have fed others, who have grown things that were their vegetables and maybe shared them, certainly okra, watermelon, sesame, but then who have been the nurturers in many ways.
So is that how the African influence became so pervasive across racial groups in the South when the region has had this long history of racial division?
Oh, yeah, I think so. You know, we're getting
ready. The cook is black.
Usually. Yeah. Not always, but often. And, I mean, we're getting ready to see that film, The Help. And even if there was not a cook per se, there might have been a day worker. There might have been a cleaning lady who made lunch. But there were all sorts of interactions over food, not necessarily sitting at the same table, that we hadn't thought about.
But then the person who's eating the food has to like what the cook has put in front of him.
Certainly, but in many cases, these people were caretakers of the young or the elderly who often didn't have a choice. And so the tastes probably became ingrained tastes so that they become, you were speaking earlier of sense memory. I went to the High School of Performing Arts, so I remember doing all of those sense memory exercises. But the whole notion of those taste memories and how those foods became those taste memories then makes those foods compelling.
When you went to Africa and you smelled things, did that evoke sense memories of food
absolutely.
From the United States?
Absolutely.
How much Do African-American cuisines resemble their African sources?
Some cases it's flagrant. I remember being in Charleston, South Carolina, with a group of friends, all of whom had an experience in Senegal. And none of us had been to Charleston before. We sat down and we were asked, do you want white rice or do you want red rice? And Charleston red rice is a classic, you know, South Carolina dish. So we all said red rice. They served it. We all took two peeks at the plate, a half a taste, and simultaneously said, Chebujan! So in some cases, it's flagrant in that manner. In others, it's more subtle. It can be the heightened sense of chilies, of pepper, whether it's chili, usually not black pepper, usually chili or hot sauce. I go back and forth to New Orleans, and certainly that long, thin bottle of hot sauce is part of it, too.
Of course, those chilies come from Mesoamerica.
They absolutely.
But it is interesting you mentioned New Orleans, because it's my sense that although we're talking about food from the African diaspora, New Orleans cuisine is very different than the food of Charleston or Savannah.
Oh, absolutely. New Orleans is a linchpin. New Orleans is kind of a pivot, if you will. They used to have T-shirts there before I started going to New Orleans that said, the South is north of here. And that's accurate. New Orleans is probably culturally more linked with what's south of New Orleans than with what's north of New Orleans. And so it's kind of the juncture.
Well, since slaves also came from all over Africa, not even just West Africa, but in some cases they had been captured in Central Africa. I'm assuming that they brought a lot of different histories with them. And did they all start merging at some point?
Well, I think one of the things that happens, if you start to look at the foods of the African continent in general compass, in gross generality, with the accent probably on the word gross, is the whole notion of a soupy stew over a starch. I mean, you know, Africa's a continent, so if you talk about foods, even the foods of Senegal are regional. Something like soupy kanya is from the south. Something like Chebujen may be more widely diffused. But when you start looking at those cuisines, that whole notion of a soupy stew, something long, low, and slow cooked, that's then served over a starch, and the starch may change. It may be rice. It may be pounded fufu. It may be banana or plantain. It may be yam, and I mean true yam, not sweet potatoes, which is one of my battles. But all of that sort of morphs all the way up and down from your tagine that's served with couscous sometimes.
Now, you really want us to make a distinction between yams and sweet potatoes.
Oh, my goodness, yes. They're different things botanically.
Why do people confuse them? Because they look like potatoes and they're kind of sweet?
No, they don't even look like potatoes and they're not sweet. A yam is something different botanically. I wish I could get the Latin in my head, but I'm not going to do that. But the bottom line is they are two entirely different plants. The things that we see as yams in most supermarkets are not yams, unless we live in a Hispanic area, and then what we see as ñame is a yam. But that's sort of fibrous on the outside, brown, and can be any color on the inside from purplish mauve all the way through white, and tastes more like an Irish potato.
Well, we're talking about foods as though they're pure, but all of these cuisines are fusion cuisines.
Oh, absolutely.
For example, in Senegal, I'm sure there's a strong French influence, as if you go to you go to one of the former British colonies, Nigeria, whatever, you're going to see a British influence. And then these foods came here, and they were influenced by Spanish food and by
French food all
French
over
food
again.
And English food.
Precisely. But I think no food is pure in that sense. I mean, no food is in an absolute. It's all fusion. It's all fusion, but it's an organic kind of fusion, so that as the people themselves are fused, as the people themselves have morphed, Senegal, which is probably the place on the African continent that I know best, when you look at people from the north, from Saint-Louis de Senegal or from Gorée Island, you've got that whole tradition of women who were called signards, who were mixed, and who were mixed very early on. That whole idea of coastal Atlantic Creoles on the eastern side of the Atlantic is something we think of not terribly often.
And what happens when the food then moves north and west?
Oh, well, then the food gets incredible. I mean, it inflects. I mean, food is constantly growing. Food is constantly changing, as you know. I'm, you know, preaching to the choir.
Well, if what is what we call soul food something that is kind of a northern version of southern food?
Twanging on my last nerve. The term soul food kind of makes me crazy because when you say soul food, you immediately think fried chicken, smothered pork chop, collard greens.
I like all those things.
I do too. Something stewed, but it's warm, comforting, ultimately food for the soul. I contend that soul food is probably not something that it was called at the period we think it was called. Somebody might have said, I got to go feed my soul tonight. And gradually that may have morphed to soul food. I'm not even sure when it actually came into the language. But we all start to think of it as being too fat, too salty, not particularly healthy. And since soul food is the only food of the African experience that most folks know, then we tend to throw out the baby with bathwater.
And it's interesting that so much of the African experience was in farming. And yet, when we talk today about organic farming and locavore, there are only a few African-American faces in the movement.
Very few. I mean, Will Allen, bless him, his sainted Will Allen.
He's been a wonderful guest on this show. The man who convinced me to go out and get worms.
Oh, okay. That's good. I just think that the whole notion of this tradition, all of Carolina's rice culture, or much of it, I like to always hedge my bet, much of it came from Western Africa. This sort of agricultural know-how that then got transplanted, the idea of letting cattle forage, certainly African from herding tribes, people who you know, the Tuareg, the Fulani, who were great herdsmen. And I wish I could quote myself as well as you've quoted me, but Texas Longhorn cattle have an African antecedent, and that's certainly one of the things that when I found...
From Kenya, I would assume,
because... possibly, but also all of that Fulani belt, sort of Mali, northern Senegal, all around there, Niger, have cattle as well. So, you know, there are all of these expertises that we don't necessarily know about today, but that ironically, slave traders did know about.
You talk about restaurants as being among the birthplaces of democracy in the United States. How so?
Oh, do I?
Although you also point out that it's been difficult for black cooks to break into the restaurant world. I could think of two or three, but not Edna Lewis being the most famous here.
Edna Lewis being the most famous, certainly here in New York City, then we've got probably, you know, each town may have someone. I think Miss Edna is the one who became the widest known nationally. But I think one of the things that's interesting, and when I talk about restaurants and democratization, I'm also talking about the whole notion of the birth of restaurants, which, of course, is 18th century Paris. And they're coming along just prior to the French Revolution. So it's a democratization of everything. It's going from that royal table to a table d'hôte, if you will, or a place pour se restaurer, where you can restore yourself, which was very different from inns or coffee houses or those kinds of things. So in that sense, certainly a democratization. But within this country, one of the things that's been interesting is that many people have been able to make their way, if you will, to find a path economically through restaurants. Not necessarily gaining honor and glory, but through restaurants. Although we have a tradition of people like Thomas Downing, who had oyster houses and Dorsey's and a whole series of caterers in Philadelphia. But the traditional African-American mode has been more toward catering because you don't need those setup costs.
Well, the most famous celebrity chef in New York who died a few years back, Patrick Clark. But he cooked French food or French reflected American food.
He did, but his father was also a cook. And Patrick, who I knew, always would put a little fillip on something. I think he actually had a barbecue grill put into, you know, Tavern on the Green when he was head chef there.
And he had one put into his hospital room when he was dying.
Well.
I gather all the people in the ward would come by his room sniffing away and saying, can I have a little taste?
Right.
Jessica B. Harris is the author of 11 cookbooks that document the foods and foodways of the African diaspora. And now she has written High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America, with a foreword by Maya Angelou. It is published by Bloomsbury. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with a conversation I had with Jessica B. Harris this past June. She was here to discuss her latest book, High on the Hog, A Culinary Journey from Africa to America. One of the things I asked her was, are you finding that more and more African Americans are interested in their culinary past? Because I find it fascinating that the chef owner of a hot new restaurant that opened up recently in Harlem to celebrate African cuisine comes from Sweden.
Marcus
Samuelson.
I know. In fact, I saw Marcus. He's launching a discussion series and all sorts of things. He's got marvelous plans. But that's a way of, you know, it's a tip of the talk, if you will. It's saying that this is food that is as influential and has the potential to be, if you will, you were just playing a lovely jazz excerpt. You can riff on food. I mean, and I think the whole notion of the food of the African experience in the United States is perfect for being riffed on, if you will. In fact, our cooking is in and of itself improvisational in many ways. So, yes, I think that the whole notion of the food of Africans as a totem, if you will, or as something that people are interested in increasingly is very important. There's a young lady on Facebook, gray hair notwithstanding, actually started looking at Facebook, who has a group called Black Culinary Historians.
And are we discovering dishes, trying to reproduce the African dishes in this country?
Well, I think that America is such an extraordinary place. I live in Brooklyn, and as I said, I know Senegal fairly well, but I know Senegal well enough to know that the Wolofs are uptown around 116th Street. The Tout Couleur are in Brooklyn by me, so the Pearl, and the food is different slightly.
These are people who've come from Africa recently?
These are people who have
recently?
Come, who are recent immigrants to the United States, who have settled in New York City, and who are doing a variety of different things. So one of the things that's fun is we can have our culinary journey almost here. We can sort of taste some of the original foods, that chebujin I was talking about, the chicken yassa, some of those classic dishes, alongside some of the things that may have developed from them.
I misspoke a few minutes ago. Your publisher is Bloomsbury.
I know. I was being good, but I figured you would catch it, so I didn't have to be the bossy lady I am.
So when did you start writing about food?
Oh, my goodness. I was travel editor for Essence magazine back in the 70s, in the Marsha Gillespie, you know, regular.
So it was the traveling first and
so
tasting
the traveling,
the foods?
Well, okay, it goes even further back than that. I am the first non-UN-connected person to go to the United Nations International School. And I went from kindergarten all the way through until I went to high school. Meaning that some of my best friends in the world are, one is a Shivite Brahmin from Madras, India. The other is Bengali from Calcutta. We had a sort of core group of students and we moved all the way through. A young lady from Wales, someone from the UK, someone from Poland. And we'd eat at each other's houses. So I grew up with probably a more international palate than someone certainly of my age and certainly of my hue was likely to have in their life. And then as I began to travel with Essence and travel ultimately on my own because I did a junior year in France and a graduate year in France, I began to see other people, taste other foods, and from the travel came the food.
Well, do you consider yourself more of a journalist or an academic at this point?
It depends on the day. I really don't know. I mean, I think it's fascinating to me because I'm watching food studies, and I always like to tell people that food studies are now where Black studies were in the late 60s. I mean, there's a whole push toward legitimization, if you will, and I've got my fingers up in the air making quotation marks, but the whole notion of how do we take this thing that is certainly something that has deep history and gravitas, if you will, and make it something that can continue to have deep history and gravitas and be worthy of formal study without creating a whole lot of jargon and making people crazy.
Because food really is a reflection of all the other things that are going on in a culture.
Absolutely.
Whether we're talking about African-American food or French food or in America or whatever.
Any kind of food. I mean, we all have to eat. And that's the thing that's so fascinating about food studies. When I did the first book, which was about foods made with peppers.
How did you wind up writing that book?
Through being a travel editor and, you know, the editorial calendar. And so one day we were in an editorial meeting. I came up with the brilliant idea. Why don't I do 1 month straight travel and 1 month travel and food? So we came up with a rubric, I'm sorry, the Go Gourmet. And alternate months I would write about food and travel. So I went to West Africa and to Martinique and ultimately to places like China and to a variety of different places, but always thinking perhaps at that point more about the food and how it related than, you know, necessarily the museums or the other kind of tourism destinations. But out of that, when I got to the Hot Stuff book, I realized that was all well and good, but what I was reading, rather than working on recipe or thinking about things, was Gene Anderson's wonderful book on peppers, Marco Polo's diaries, Columbus's diaries. And so the academic kind of kicked in another way. Hence, I guess that's why I became a food historian.
What kind of food did you grow up eating?
Well, my mother was actually a trained dietitian. My mother had an AA degree from Pratt in dietetics in the class of 1932 or something like that, so back in the day. So I grew up eating well-balanced meals. And, you know, I'd had a meat and something colorful, orange or red or something, and something green, and a salad, and a starch. You know, it was before the pyramid. I am BP in that sense, so before pyramid. But I grew up with well-balanced meals. My father was hardscrabble South. And so he would every once in a while put his foot down and go, Rhoda, no, I need some neck bones tonight. So that kind of alternated with the neck bones and the ham hocks and the collard greens. And, you know, so we'd have veal cutlets one night and smothered pork chops another.
Why do you think it's taken so long for universities to find food studies a worthy topic? I mean, we have a department at NYU that's quite
certainly
huge.
That's astonishing.
And
wonderful.
Anytime anybody needs any information about food, they go to Marian Nestle automatically.
Precisely.
But we're not seeing that in all the universities.
No, I live in hope that the one that's developing at the City University in the City University system will stay teaching long enough to actually be able to teach in it. But I think the thing is that the academy is changing. I look at what people are majoring in. I mean, we've got, you know, popular culture. We've got textile studies. There are all sorts of things that didn't exist. When I went to school, it was like you were going to be a doctor, you're going to be a lawyer, arguably not an Indian chief, but you were going to be doing something that was standard.
But people have been talking about food as an academic subject for a long time. They just weren't doing it as food. For example, I'm thinking about all of the things in the Schomburg Center and then Kitchen Arts and Letters and those oral histories that the WPA collected that often involved people talking about food.
Absolutely, because if we don't eat, we die. So food is kind of foremost in the human mind, and certainly when you get to a point where you're stressed, whether it's financially or emotionally, one of the things that you're going to worry about is food. What am I going to have to eat? Where am I going to have, where am I going to get it? That wonderful, and I'm going to misquote the title, but the book that Cara da Silva did about Memory's Kitchen, that whole notion of what are the things that you think about when you are in a bad place.
In her case, she found these recipes that had been written by women in the concentration camp.
Exactly.
And their
memories. From memory.
And they were all, the recipes were totally inaccurate, but it was important for them to try to hold on
Precisely.
To those memories.
So for the formerly enslaved of the WPA, that idea of the memory of food, because remember, WPA was during the Depression, and for many of the formerly enslaved, that was worse, if it's possible to believe. So that whole notion of how do we begin to look at these things, there's a magazine that was published by Tuskegee that I didn't even realize until I found it, that contained recipe and information.
Just one more thing. A number of listeners have asked me to ask you about Brian Terry and what he's doing.
Oh, Brian Terry, I love. I did a blurb for his first book. The whole idea of vegan soul is another kind of way of moving. This is not a static thing. This is something that grows in multiple directions.
Well, in Africa, isn't the vegetable still the primary ingredient of the dish?
The vegetable is central. And if we look at traditional, probably African-American cooking, when you start looking at those rations that were being given to the enslaved, there wasn't a whole lot of animal protein. This diet was pretty much vegetarian.
Do you think that's why the animal protein has become so much an important part
Absolutely.
Of the African-American diet?
I think it's one of those things of, what shall we say, of prosperity. So now that I can afford something other than that little tiny measly seasoning piece of fat back, I'll put in last night's ham and three ham hocks and, you know, a leftover whatever else I can find.
Jessica B. Harris, her latest book, which is her 12th book.
Yes.
The previous 11 were mostly cookbooks. This book is a history, a cultural history, a culinary journey from Africa to America that she calls High on the Hog. It's published by Bloomsbury, and it's been a great pleasure talking with you today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Joel Meyerowitz was the only professional photographer granted entry to Ground Zero. On tomorrow's show, he discusses making a record of the recovery efforts after 9/11. Also, a woman describes her recovery after flames in the World Trade Center burned 80% of her body. And then Alexandra Styron on growing up the daughter of the brilliant and tormented writer William Styron, plus a look at how architecture has changed since 9/11. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Max Bass, Sarah Franklin, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. Happy Labor Day, and we'll see you tomorrow.